This is a reading from The War on Waste Innovation, Chapter 1, Part 4, Black Knights. We've spent a good deal of time talking about Black Knights. They are the people in any organization who interfere with the implementation of ideas. They are usually those in the organization that don't want change. For them, they have a nice little life that change will disrupt. So let's go into that a little bit more. We got the idea of the Black Knight from the Monty Python movie In Search of the Holy Grail. There's a scene in the movie in which the Black Knight is defending a bridge against another knight who wants to cross the bridge. Of course, the Black Knight wins. He always wins. As King Arthur approaches, he asks to cross the bridge. The Black Knight refuses, and a battle begins with swords clashing, and ultimately the Black Knight loses an arm. It is but a scratch. Then the other arm and in both legs. As he sits there, the Black Knight is a stump of his former self. King Arthur calls it a draw and moves on across the bridge. Why is this so funny? Well, the bridge is over a small creek, and King Arthur could just as well have jumped across the creek and continued on his way. But he doesn't. He must cross that bridge. So a couple of things are going on. The Black Knight is defending a stupid position, the bridge across the creek. And King Arthur challenges him, probably unnecessarily. I enjoyed this scene because I had seen it just after I had an encounter with a Black Knight in a small business. He ended up defending the status quo, and a CEO told him emphatically that they were going forward with a great idea that an employee had suggested. The CEO had not lopped off his arms and legs yet, but he got to the point. Of course, the CEO prevailed, and from that point forward, our use of this analogy has been an integral part of the war on waste. In a typical engagement, I might show the Black Knight scene from In Search of the Holy Grail. You can go view it on YouTube, and it is very, very funny. And I might say something like, most companies have a few of these people around, and then I might ask something like, do you have any of those people here? And boy, do I get laughs. And lots of people looking around the room, checking to see none was in the room, and mouthing a name or two. But as I noted in the previous section, we're trying to get along better with Black Knights, and we discovered a way we can do it by focusing on the tribal knowledge paradigm. In fact, it is through our encounters with Black Knights that our solution to a better paradigm emerged. After all, we need to give them an alternative management option. The proposed option will allow them to save face and join the team. Change without reprisal. This is what the war on waste is all about. If you want to make your organization receptive to change, there can be no reprisal. Getting even on people who offer suggestions for improvement. We must protect those ideas for change with no blame. It is no blame change, and it is the foundation of what we call the tribal knowledge paradigm. In one of my early engagements, a worker was really excited about an idea that he had. He went home on the first weekend of the war on waste and drew up a precise engineering rendering of his solution. He was not an engineer. He was a line worker in a factory, and he was excited about what he had done. He gave his papers to the foreman, who was just throwing out the coffee grounds for the first pot. The foreman looked at the papers, then dropped them into the garbage can, followed by the grounds. The poor employee grabbed his papers from the garbage and ran over to me. He was angry and afraid. He was angry that his hard work was dismissed so casually, and he was afraid that the foreman was going to do something to him. Of course, the foreman tried, but we were able to protect our employee's idea and turn it into a success. It was a wonderful idea that cost about $100 to implement and increased the output of his work area by 15%. $250,000 of increased output per year. John Steinbeck may have said it best, and I believe this, he says, that the free, exploring mind of the individual human is the most valuable thing in the world. And this I would fight for. The freedom of the mind to take any direction it wishes, undirected. And this I might fight against. Any idea, religion, or government, and I threw in the word corporation, which limits or destroys the individual. This is what I am and what I am about. I won't get into what I did with the foreman. It was not basically very pretty. After all, that foreman had just thrown down the gauntlet to me. Believe me, I was up for the challenge. You don't do what he did to anyone. You just don't. Ideas must be accompanied without an attitude of reprisal of any sort. And as leaders, we must fight to protect those with the ideas. No excuses. The no blame motto was developed to encourage employees to come up with ideas. It serves as their protection from the black knights that fight change in the organization. But there is a downside. When an employee evokes no blame, there is no accountability. That's why we came up with the idea of no excuses. When an employee fails to measure up to its capabilities, they accept the consequences and report the data honestly. They do so with the understanding that no blame is the operating philosophy of the company. And that is what we want. However, a manager has the right to investigate the reason for the low performance under the banner of no excuses. In other words, workers use no blame and the managers invoke no excuses. We call this accountability. An interesting note here is Silicon Valley executive T.J. Rogers, who leads with no excuses in his management and holds people accountable to a rather stern management approach. However, there is no shield with no blame. I don't necessarily agree with what he does or how he goes about it, but his results are most impressive. Mabel. Mabel is an important person in the evolution of the war on waste. The story began over 30 years ago as I stood in front of a group of employees who had been forced to attend a class I had been contracted to deliver. It was a training program that introduced a small manufacturing company to the principles of the Toyota production system. In essence, I was teaching a method for identifying and eliminating waste in business processes. To illustrate my thoughts about how this system could be applied to American industry, I'd prepared over 160 slides, including charts, graphs, illustration, text, and checklists. I was going to show these slides in conjunction with a series of interactive lectures scheduled to run for 10 weeks at the rate of 3 one-hour sessions per week. And with all of my projects, the entire company was required to attend, everyone from custodial personnel to the CEO. On the very first day of class, I had a rude awakening. I introduced myself and moved right into my presentation, feeling pretty good about the way things were going. I was on the fourth slide and I noticed a raised hand in the back of the room. "Yes," I asked, wondering what could be confusing this early in the presentation. After all, this was the great Lambertine in front of her, right? "My name is Mabel," she said, "and I have a problem." Mabel was a middle-aged production worker who had labored on the production line over 20 years. "I can't understand your slides," she said. I asked her why not, expecting a smart-ass answer and thinking wearily to myself that there was always one in every group. Her answer astounded me. "I can't read," she said. So I tried to clarify what she had said. "Do you mean you can't read? See my slides clearly?" "No. I'm illiterate," she said. "I can't read." I was blown away. the whole 4 months' worth of material I had prepared would be of no value to her, nor to anyone else that couldn't read. I had assumed reading was a basic skill, forgetting that some production and line workers don't have much more than an elementary school education, yet they all needed to learn the skills outlined in this new management system. How would I keep Mabel up to speed with the rest of the class? I didn't want to single her out any more than she already was, yet it was imperative that I communicate to this class in a way the rest of the classes would find compelling and appropriate. I had very little time to decide. 40 pairs of eyes rested on me, waiting for my next move. And the war on waste emerged. I appealed to their individualism by opening up the lecture to employees and posing a question. Did they know any wasteful processes currently in place at the company? My question was generated with hearty laughter. Talking about how messed up the company is has to be every employee's favorite pastime. But before the conversation could deteriorate into a negative company bashing free-for-all, because that's what it was quickly becoming, I outlined a few rules. I call this chalking the field, which is defining the boundaries of the discussion. We would identify a wasteful process and make an early attempt in finding the root cause of the problem. I told them not to worry about what anyone else would think about the idea, not to blame anyone for an inefficient process in place. I wanted them to concentrate on thinking of the best way to solve the problem. The removal of blame allowed the full force of individual and employee individualism. When you identify a waste, you experience the strength of individual thinking. And because Mabel spoke English and had ideas, she became intimately involved in all that was going on in this process. Hands shot up faster than I could call on people. People turned from every corner of the room were sharing their thoughts about things that just weren't working right in the company. For example, poor lighting in the production area caused workers to make mistakes. Disorganized machine tools and fixtures wasted a lot of time. Inventory not there when it was needed for the assembly wasted even more time. Poorly designed packaging wasted employee time because all four sides of the packaging boxes took a long time to tape. Expensive styrofoam cups were used in the coffee room, and so on. The list developed over a couple of days until we had about 45 different items to think about for this group. I listed each item on a flip chart using pictures and simple diagrams whenever possible. I was thrilled by the enthusiasm I was seeing. All the ideas weren't big money makers, but the enthusiasm was intoxicating. While I always tried to make my lectures interesting, I'd never experienced participation on this level. But it made perfect sense. These people spent their lives in the trenches, working with these inefficient processes day after day, until I imagined some of them wanted to scream out of sheer frustration. They'd never before been asked to voice their opinion. And finally, someone was asking them, what was wrong with the company? What a rush. And Mabel was the impetus for the war on waste methodology that evolved from her initial input to the war on waste. Thank you very much. This is the end of part 4 of the war on waste innovation. By the way, you can find out more about the war on waste by going to www.waronwasteacademy.com or www.lynnbertainsbooks.com. Thank you very much.